Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 199 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
And the Rev.
And Marco is currently in the Whosium Zero Room. So we're just going to proceed now to the Harry Sullivan Memorial Sick Bay.
Don't you mean in February?
No, I mean the sick bay, where we will find Mark recuperating in the Whosium Zero Room. A little amazed getting there. You were unravelling your baggy jumper, weren't you, Rev, so we could find our way back.
Oh, I thought it was getting chilly in here.
Oh, I think here we are. Ah, Mark, there you are.
Oh, hi, guys.
Hey, Mark.
It's nice up here.
Ooh, you look very ashen.
You haven't come to put me in that little cabinet and take me into the main museum recording area, have you?
Well, funny you should say that, Mark.
Hang on, I haven't quite got all of the sherry out of the little cabinet. Just a minute. That's it. Sorted.
Right, Rev, have you got your Black & Decker power tool?
Oh, yes.
Right, we're just going to dismantle the Zero Room, Mark.
Oh.
Cover your ears.
Sonic
hammer action.
Right. There we go.
Right. And then we'll just make this into a man-sized cabinet. I also have a sliding lid so that we can occasionally check on Mark. Right, do you want to pop inside, Mark?
Oh, if I must.
I don't want to get in the box.
Right. Oh, it's too heavy. I can't carry this. Has anyone got a wheelchair? Right. 1, 2, 3, Rev, then we'll pump it up onto the wheelchair, all right? 1, 2, 3.
Oh, hang on. Oh, just a minute. Let me get Great Aunt Margaret out with it first.
Remember, don't dump podcasters into the river.
Oh, the poor lad's delirious.
Right. 1, 2, 3. Who? Right.
Oh, I think I've pulled my fluid links doing that.
Right, so I'll just get the microphone and I'll plug it into the socket in the Zero cabinet. Can you hear us in there, Mark?
Hello? Reading you loud and clear.
So, Mark, you have been in the wars of late, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Today finds me having just been... today's find... Sorry, I'm giggling. It's, that's all the gas in the...
The opium.
In the Zero Room. Yeah, I had 6-hour surgery on my left ear yesterday, which was quite a thing. So I'm not quite altogether my normal self at this recording session, so I do apologise. I've got a huge bandage on my head. I look somewhat like Terry Butcher coming off the pitch for England back in whenever it was.
I'd say more like Mr. You look more like Mr. Bump from here.
Yeah, so I had 6 hours surgery on my ear. My eardrum has basically, over the years, it developed a hole years and years ago, and then it's just eventually disappeared to nothing now. It's just that you can see straight in and see all the inside workings of my ear, which is very disturbing. When they showed it to me on a camera, although apparently it was a great privilege to see the inside of someone's ear like that. So, yeah, so 6 hours, because you got to go in there, you got to sanitise the whole thing before you seal it up, and there's all those fine little bones in there, so it's a lot of work. When I came to from the anaesthetic, the first thing I said to the surgeon was, "Doctor, will I ever play the piano again?"
Yes, you'll be able to play it brilliantly.
Yeah, well, I couldn't before. It all went a bit devil's cord. The surgeon pulled out a massive tuning fork. And I was like, oh no, what's she going to do with it? And she hit me on the head with it and then stuck it on the side of my head and went, can you hear this?
were you under medication here? Were you in an episode of The Sooty Show?
I don't know. It was bizarre. I mean, I was heavily medicated and possibly still am.
Is that true about the tuning fork?
Yeah. She had a massive tuning fork in her pocket. It's pulled out, hit me on the head with it, and then then stuck the end of it on my head and said, can you hear this? And I said, yes, I can. She said, which ear? And I said, it's the left one, which had just been done the work on, and it was all good.
What note was it?
I don't know. I think it was H. That's how good my hearing is now. Anyway, so, yeah, I'm currently bandaged up and just having a nice little lie down Zero cabinet. It's good there's a couple of bottles left in here. I wonder how they're mixed with my painkillers.
You keep your hands off me glacé cherries.
Well, it's not the first time I've heard that said in anger.
So they spent 6 hours building a new eardrum for you?
Yeah. Tympanoplasty, I believe it's called.
A man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
He was Cyberman then.
What's it called?
Tympanoplasty.
That's one of Elon Musk's kids, isn't it?
Maybe you'll be able to hear me next time I give you instructions on the podcast for once, Mark.
I saw it, Doc, you're cutting out.
Wow, you can't hear Doc's voice. They've done a great job on that. Sign me up.
I chucked him a 10 and asked them to throw it in. Oh, can I just tell you about the shocking experience I had whilst I was there? I came out of the operation, I'd just been hit on the head with a tuning fork, and then I was taken off to go and lie down in my bed to recover.
What, from the operation or the hit on the head with a tuning fork?
And I was laid there, I'd just been chucked on this bed, and this huge matronly woman came over.
Hattie Jakes, are we saying?
She comes over and she's like, now then, darling, is there anything you need? And I said, actually, I think I need a wee. And without another word, she pushed me back on the bed. Suddenly, these gloves had appeared on her hand from nowhere. I don't know how that happened. And she was suddenly pushed back on the bed and was crackling around under my hospital gown and jamming one of those cardboard things on top of me. And I was absolutely terrified. She said, I'll come back in 5 minutes. I just laid there for 5 minutes going...
like Kenneth Williams.
But she came back after 5 minutes ago. Have you done? And I was like, well, no, because it's all disappeared. It's all run away until you've gone.
So, since we last gathered, we have, of course, lost William Russell, haven't we?
Oh.
Yeah.
Mark, Hayden and I were fortunate enough almost to the day, 7 years ago, we visited the Phantom Films event in Rickmansworth, where we got William's or Russ's, whatever we call him, autographed, didn't we, Mark?
Yeah.
And I shook hands with him, shortly before dashing to the door with the most appalling case of food poisoning. You remember that?
Yes, I do remember that, yeah. You just managed to hang in there long enough to see Ian Levine doing his a turn on the stage, didn't he?
Oh, so maybe it wasn't food poisoning after all. What we're going to be doing is we'll probably do a podcast in the very near future as a tribute to Russ.
Yes, definitely.
But Mark, you were saying Well, it's unusual. I don't say it's not like another death, but it feels unusual, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, but there's something about William Russell. There's something about the sort of effect he had on the show and the presence he had and everything he brought to the part of Ian. You know, that warmth and charm and gentlemanliness. And that's sort of that adventure book hero. And he really epitomised that in those early serials. And he's such a touchstone for that era. I mean, the thing is, I think once people start getting to their 90s and stuff, it feels like they're going to be around forever in a way, doesn't it? And they may have lived incredibly long lives, but their sudden loss is... it was just a loss that I really felt. Just felt like we'd lost an integral part of the actual show's DNA, really.
He literally had always been there, hadn't he?
Mm.
Any of your thoughts, Ralph?
I think it was an interesting character because he had the uniqueness, didn't he? It was very different, that first ever episode of Doctor Who, which set it all up. It was proper good quality BBC mystery sci-fi of the time, very quiet.
Yeah.
And he was a yarn ripper and a swashbuckler, as you say. But he was in there, really, because he was almost the leading guy, wasn't he? Because the Doctor was more of a background character in many ways. We've got the companions whose eyes we see it through, but Ian was there for the heavy lifting and the punching and the fighting. And it was quite unique to the series, because once William Hartnell had gone, then, of course, the Doctor took a more prominent position because they had younger actors playing him. So I think it's something that vanished for a long time.
Well, I would say once William Russell left, the Doctor, even William Hartnell, started becoming more swashbuckling and and fighting and stuff. Oh, well, I mean, he was in the Romans and things like that when he was still there. But so there was that changeover. So yeah, yes, there was that gradual changeover.
It's a phrase we've already used, isn't it? You know, any of these milestones happening in the series, it's a gear change to the series. When he left and Barbara left, it did change the way that the series worked. And, you know, those changes kept coming.
Yeah.
I wonder if the difference is that he's really been the only ever, certainly male companion, who hasn't been, like, the Doctor's sidekick or straight man.
Yes.
If you know what I mean. Like you were saying, he was effectively a co-lead with the Doctor, wasn't he? Maybe alongside Jackie Hill.
He spent a lot of time fighting against the Doctor, didn't he, really? And the Doctor's, you know, desire to get into, you know, scrapes or prove things. Very much the committed teacher and role model that, you know, that he should be.
It's interesting, that, isn't it? I just think about that dynamic, because obviously we've been watching the new series, but that dynamic where there's friction with companions and people in TARDIS, and there's pushbacks and things like this. Whereas, you know, in this current series, it's all just been, we're the best friends from day one. That's felt a bit lacking in the new series, which we'll probably go on to mention later.
But now you know, Rev, how your students possibly see you.
Well, you mean like Chesterton? The scatty old man who lives in a box. Yeah, the one who's cool and hip and up on music. Yeah, really. I put a little video together at work yesterday to help students use Photoshop. And one student says across the room, how'd you do this, Rev? And I said, it's on the video. And they went, yeah, but it's hard to see. I said, oh, thanks very much. I know I'm no Steven Spielberg. And they went, who? I said, Steven Spielberg is a famous director. And the student next to her went, is he? Well, I've never heard of him. He can't be that famous. So there you go.
God. What?
Not even with it on the directors anymore.
Blimey. Gosh.
And these are the people, Rev, whose TikTokery mania you were mere weeks ago holding up to me as the great way of progress.
I don't know. I'm going to have another swig of this Grenadier. Grenadier?
Of this what?
Grenadine, isn't it?
Grenadine, isn't it?
I haven't got a grenadier in here.
I've told you, Private Humphreys shouldn't be here when we're recording. back to sentry duty.
Oh, you actually got a grenadine with you?
It's in the drinks cabinet. The zero cabinet's made out of a booze cabinet, isn't it? You haven't cleaned out the back area. Full of all sorts. That advocat's been in there since Mars first stint on the podcast. Don't be drinking that.
No, I'd need an ice pick to get out of that bottle now.
So, as I've said, we'll devote a coming podcast to Russ's time on the show and his life. Anything else been happening in our lives before we get stuck in? Talking of ice picks, just pass me that one, Mark. I need to sharpen it.
Oh, wow. Oh, so Zandy's been enjoying the TV.
Whatever happened to Doctor Who?
He got an ice pick that made his ears burn. No more heroes anymore. Oh, no. Is that what you can call the episode, No More Heroes?
Whatever happened to RTD?
He's about to get an ice pick.
He certainly is. So, anything fascinating happening in your life, Rev?
Not that springs to mind, no. Been pretty mundane, I think, yeah.
Right. In that case...
Is Pretty Mundane one of the characters from Dot and Bubble?
Oh, that's quite clever, that, actually. Dot and Bubble was the fifth episode of the current series, directed by Dylan Holmes Williams, who, didn't he direct...
73 Yards?
Yes, I think he did, didn't he? Oh, careful. Written by Russell T. Davis. Anyone want to start, or...?
I don't really want to start, because I don't think I'm not sure.
I don't know if I've got a huge amount to say. Man's just quite quick and chirpy, probably, I think, maybe.
The second Doctor Light episode in a mere 8 episodes, isn't it? In fact, the second one running, wasn't it?
Yes.
I thought that it was an absolutely extraordinarily well-written and well-performed 2 minutes. But I have to say that the preceding 41 minutes rather left me cold.
I'm just going to shut the cabinet doors for 5 minutes.
The first thing I thought was when you see her in her little pastel Barbie world was, it's very much like the sort of thing that seems to be everywhere on TV now. Probably comprises half of the content on Netflix these days. People trying to do versions of Black Mirror. And I must say, it's all of those bright, clean pastels just didn't really seem to be very Doctor Who-ish in atmosphere. And as powerful as the ending is, I'm really not sure how many people would be interested in rewatching any more than the final couple of minutes of the episode. So how soon, dear, this is the point at which we find out whether the Diddly Dum podcast is going to be cancelled on social media. So how soon in the 43 minutes of the episode did each of us twig that there were no black people in this society?
I didn't until it was mentioned.
Oh. Can I just say, I feel really sorry for people that had to come in who do hot take reviews of this, like our friends on the Doctor Who show.
Friends?
Because, to come straight off and just do a bit straight away without sort of mulling it over or getting a chance to rewatch it or catch up with The Unleashed and things, it's a tough gig, I think, sometimes. I noticed, I think, I can't remember when it was now, there was one point, probably about halfway through, where she had, the whole screen was filled with dozens of these faces. And that was when I suddenly thought, I remember thinking, that's odd, because diversity casting's just normal. It's the normal thing. So I was puzzled at that point, and I thought, this is weird. Why is this? I mean, I guess I thought this must be deliberate, but what if it's not? But it clearly was. So I did notice about halfway through, I think it was.
Halfway through? You are so woke, Mark. You social justice warrior.
Well, one extreme to the other, isn't it?
Neither of you need to feel ashamed, because the penny dropped for me roughly about half an hour after the episode had ended.
Oh, no.
I just didn't twig, even at the end. Because once you were saying, you can't join us, we can't be coming contaminated. I was thinking, it's just because they're aliens. The Doctor and Ruby. To be fair, I was thinking as the final credits were going up, oh, I wonder if we're supposed to think that it's because the Doctor's black. And then I thought, oh no, maybe they're leaving it for us to make our own minds up. Because when I went online, I realised, no, actually, it wasn't that at all. I don't think it helped that because I was so uninterested in so much of the preceding 41 minutes, I just wasn't really concentrating on all this bubble and the faces in it, except when she was talking to the Doctor and Ruby. So it may well be that's why I wasn't really noticing.
I do think that it's very easy. If you're, I mean, where I live in Kent, I see very few black people, really. Even when I went to a thing at Margate, I went to go and see Parliament Funkadelic at Margate. There's one big group of black people who seem to be in the audience dancing around all day. And I thought, oh, well, that's good. And they've all come dressed up, all very jazzy. And they were like the only black people who I saw in the audience at the huge funk gig in Margate. And it turned out that that was actually Funkadelic. So that was them dancing around to other bands who were on stage before they came on. So it can be very normal for me to go about my day and not see a single black face.
It is in my location as well. We're a set of one East Riding of Yorkshire village after another, and it's very much the same.
Yes, yes, it is. And that's what you're used to. So your brain doesn't always ring
exactly.
Alarm bells when that seems to be the normal on the television.
But I've got to admit that I've written this down because I was trying to think of something to compare it to. In the same way, I've never watched an episode of Red Dwarf and gone, oh, look, there's two black blokes in this cast.
No. Well, no.
You know, it's never crossed my mind. It's just Red Dwarf. So, you know.
Yeah, and also, I think if you're not particularly engaging with the episode terribly or enjoying it, it's probably very easy for your mind to slide off it a bit, isn't it? So, and just, like, you know.
I've got less excuse than either of you because I've lived all my life in Manchester and London. I suppose there's another way of looking at it, which is that if we're hoping that the goal of society is that one day we won't notice the colour of people's skins, then the fact that all the woke Doctor Who fans boasting about how soon they noticed the skin colour of all the actors, they're the backward ones living in the 1950s, while it's people like the three of us who are the forward-looking pioneers of the New Jerusalem. To be fair, all of the most irritating, gormless people I do come across on social media do seem to be white people a lot of the time. So maybe that's why I didn't see anything unusual about it.
Well, also, in the world of Doctor Who fandom, it's very white, isn't it? Let's be honest.
I do think this sometimes, yeah.
Doctor Who fandom is very white.
It does seem to be, doesn't it?
I mean, I know the Time Team, or whatever they're called, they tried to...
Oh, DWM.
Yes, they have a bit more diversity, didn't they? Which was good, but...
Oh my God, I've just realised who all the vapid faces of the influencers in the bubble remind me of. It's the DWM Time Team. Well, it could be that given our ages, we're more likely to follow Doctor Who fans on social media who are as much into Classic Who as New Who. And Classic Who, the show itself, was very white. Maybe we miss that there's a larger black following of mainly New Who. I did think at first, I saw a very brief clip of Russell on Unleashed saying, imagine one of these things where, you know, you see the video clip on something like Twitter. You don't actually hear it, but you've got the subtitles of what he's saying running on it. And so he's saying something, and how long was it before you noticed, you know, that there were no black people on? And I was thinking, oh, God, he's... I'm not going to watch Unleashed because it's going to be a lecture from Russell on how much more open to diversity is. But then I did end up watching it, see if there's anything, any meanings I'd missed. And actually, he didn't seem to be doing it in a lecturing sort of way. I think he was more doing it in sort of, I thought it was something that might be interesting. I said, it certainly is interesting. But then we've been brought up on Doctor Who all our lives. Do we still notice a lack of diversity in Doctor Who? I think we've just got so used to it. I don't know if any of you saw the absolutely barking interview with Jonathan Groff in DWM.
No.
Where he talks about an unearthly child. What really struck me is the scene where the two teachers are tracking down this young girl, who you end up finding out is the granddaughter of the Doctor. They follow her into that sort of eclectic place, sort of like a junkyard with antiques everywhere. And the TARDIS is in there, and they go inside, and they can't comprehend how something so small on the outside is so big on the inside. And the Doctor says something like, it takes people a while to fully comprehend something that's so far outside what they understand. So I said to Russell, there's something innately queer to me about that. Something innately alternative feels like a direct line from that very first episode all the way through to the first gay black man playing the Doctor. And someone I follow on Twitter said, it's just interesting how many actors really seem to struggle with coherent thoughts when they don't have a script in front of them. But after all that it mentioned at the end of this interview, Jonathan Groff had never previously watched any episodes of Doctor Who, but revealed that Russell T Davies had sent him a hand-picked selection of 5 stories to get him up to speed. And it really struck me that... Yes, I watched An Unearthly Child, and it really struck me that this is the start of a direct line which will lead all the way through to the first gay black Doctor being cast 60 years later. If he's thinking that the very first episode of An Unearthly Child is the start of an inevitable progress towards the first gay black man being cast as the Doctor, then these 5 tapes that Russell sent him to give him an idea of Doctor Who must presumably have been the 5 tapes of Classic Who in which a black man was actually cast for anything. And it's a bit of a joke to pretend there's diversity in Doctor Who, even in 2024. So far, we've had 347 Doctor Who stories since 1963. 347. And how many do we think have been written by women?
Oh, God.
Well, more in the modern day series, isn't it? But even then, there was a big hoo-ha through Moffat's era, wasn't there?
I don't reckon it's into double figures, is it? Is it?
7.
347 stories and 19 have been written by women.
19? Right.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And
is that stories or episodes?
That's stories. So, for instance, in classic days, that would be the whole of, say, Brain of Morbius. In modern, it would be the whole of Dot and Bubble. Admittedly, it has perked up in the modern era. Those 19 stories written by women, 13 of them happened in the modern era. And of the 40 directed by women, 28 have happened in the modern era. But unfortunately, of the 3 showruns we've had so far, Russell's got the least, I'm afraid. And they're just about equal on the writing thing.
What about black people writing for the show?
Well, I went through and did this test ages ago, but I was going to do that. I thought, I can't do that. I can't go through a list of all the Doctor Who shows, one, and assume from someone's name.
Yeah, no, this is true.
What the colour of their skin is.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And if, let's say, someone's called Joe Bloggs.
Yeah.
That could be easy if he's a white man as a black woman, couldn't it? And then I thought, I actually found myself thinking, well, maybe I could type their name into Google and then go onto Google Images. And I thought, no, actually, that would be horrendously inappropriate to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's...
It's not going to be a lot anyway, is it?
No.
You know, it's not going to be any better than the women, I would have thought.
So Russell's done 72 stories during his 2 stints as showrunner.
Yeah.
72 stories. 7 of them have been directed by women and 5 have been written by women. But there we are.
I wonder at what point he noticed.
Yeah.
Hold on. I'll book 2 for the next episode.
Well, yeah, I suppose you could argue that this latest series is effectively the last 2 minutes of the Doctor Who story, isn't it? Talk about people suddenly starting noticing things. I think it's only in this story, isn't it, when they see that... You know when she called Lindy?
Yes.
When she mentions her mum, and her mum appears on the bubble and says, Hello, darling. And I think it's only then that the Doctor and Ruby start noticing these recurring images of Susan Twist, isn't it?
Yeah, Ruby was like, don't I know you from somewhere before in the previous episode?
Yeah. It's not really until Boomtown, is it, in Series 1, that the Doctor and Rose start noticing the instances of Bad Wolf.
Mm.
You know, when in the Mayor's office and they say that Blythe Droog thing. I hope that was acceptable for pronunciation, Mark. And Rose says, hang on, Bad Wolf, I've heard anything like that. I mean, if Rose had been on social media, she would have been able to escape it. What did we think of Lindy?
Oh, I thought she was great.
Callie Cook. She was irritating, but, yeah. But you have to remember, it's the character that's irritating, not the act.
Well played, good character.
I thought she did it really well.
Yeah, I thought she was absolutely brilliant. She was, you know, both attractive and repellent at the same time.
We had to buy the twist at the end, didn't we? The initial twist where she turned the tables on the singing guy.
Yeah.
So,
oh, Ricky September, yeah.
We had to be surprised by that, didn't we? So I think she was actually... She's like someone... I've seen people like this at the pub. They're quite pleasant company, but a bit annoying.
What did we think about that thing at the end? Obviously, when I rewatched it, it was blindingly obvious. So I think Hayden used to say that his wife, Sophie, when they were watching Doctor Who together, she would be mainly just occasionally glancing at the screen while she was playing on her phone or her tablet. And I said, I wonder if that's what I was doing while I was watching this story.
Ironically, in your bubble.
Yeah. Well, very good.
You see, I did think on Unleashed that Russell's statement about I wonder how long it took you to notice and what that says about you. I didn't need a lecture. I did see that as a lecture. I thought he'd cut people down in one sentence. just watched a TV show with a charismatic black lead who, you know, who sparkled in every scene he was in. Never crossed my mind. I'd enjoyed lots of bits and bobs in the episode, and yeah, it hadn't crossed my mind. And I was discussing this with a non-Doctor Who watching friend of mine who'd, you know, seen a couple of bits and bobs on the internet and stuff, and we were chatting about it. And he says, that said the way that it was in this speech at the end of the episode, and he said, so is Doctor Who like He-Man now? The moral at the end of the story.
Oh.
I did think it felt a bit like that. I already liked the twist that was there. I don't know if it was needed or not. I don't know. Unless it's, again, this fast-paced way of trying to cram as many different things in so that the story is different things to different people. I don't know. Maybe it is.
That's what I meant by seeing Russell on Twitter. I was thinking, if he points out this thing about how long does it take you, as a sort of, you know, a finger wagging, it'll drive me mad. But all he was saying was, I think it's just something that people might find interesting.
Oh, I didn't take it that way.
Which way?
I didn't take it that way. I thought it was a bit, how dare you? I'm not Enoch Powell.
No, you certainly are.
What do we think of those last 2 minutes then, where Shooty reacts to her effectively giving him the finger?
A lot of spitting, weren't there?
I noticed that. There's a lot of phlegm as well. On the when you see it on the Unleashed, you get to see the unfiltered from the side shot of him doing the acting, don't you? And there's that. All that spit's real. It's not been put in by post VFX.
No, I think it was the best spitting since Timothy Dalton when he was in it. What's interesting then as well, though, before we sort of talk about the last couple of minutes, is that, you know, it's not in the commentaries, it must be on Unleashed, or I've read it somewhere, that this episode was originally written for a Stephen Moffat series, wasn't it? It was commissioned earlier and written, and the idea went in early, but they just never used it.
Oh,
really? I missed that.
Yeah. I'm just trying to see if I can find what season it was. 2009.
Oh!
He pitched an episode in April 2010, and it was for Gamey Pond and 11.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
So obviously this part is an evolution to the story for this season.
Do you know, I've just realised, am I writing things about that season? Talking about Kent, Mark, in the village of Ledworth.
Yes.
Am I right in thinking that the only non-white face in that village was in the cottage hospital?
Oh, I think he might be, yeah.
I think that's true, actually. So,
well, it's very very true to Kent villages, I'm ashamed to say. Well, I'm not ashamed to say, really. It's just is. I thought the ending bit was brilliant. And to think that's the first scene that he shot as the Doctor, that's just remarkable, isn't it, really?
Yes, of course. Particularly where he's saying to her, you know, obviously the line on the script is he's saying to Lindy, I don't care what you think. Now, obviously you can interpret that in two ways. You can either say, oh, I don't care what you think, you know, you awful person. But what he's saying here is, I don't care what you think, just let me save you.
Mm.
Mm.
Which I thought, oh, that's I think that's very Doctor.
Yes.
Isn't he? You know, he's prepared to save Davros at one point, isn't he? After he's just tried to destroy the universe. On Unleashed. is it Stefan who does the presenting and says...
Lindy Pepperbean, a character who ultimately reveals herself to be entitled and racist.
And I thought, is that ... Oh, and she kills people too. When she betrayed Ricky, what's your first reaction? She's so entitled. She's actually far worse than being entitled and racist. She's a psychopath.
You know what another... maybe Russell's right, this says something about me. I mean, at the end of the day, she was going to die first, or he was. So, you know...
I don't think that says anything about you, Rev. You psychopath.
I don't know, but he was about to die in seconds.
Rev ultimately revealed himself to be entitled and selfish.
I don't think I realised until after it was over and I was kind of looking back through things how much... Ricky is just the Aryan ideal of a doctor. And it's funny because there's people on Twitter, because that's kind of what he's been put there for, right? Because she'll go with him and do whatever he says. But, you know, she's kind of really funny about doing what the black guy is telling her to do.
Yeah, that's clever, that.
And there was people online saying, oh, my God, this guy is the best doctor I've seen since Capaldi. And they were getting absolutely shot down for it. Quite right. They're basically saying, I didn't like the woman, I didn't like the black man, but I love the Aryan ideal of Doctor Who.
This is the best Doctor I've seen since I was last a white man playing him.
His character, from what he did in this episode, does mean that we can now add Timmy Mallett to the Whosium record collection.
Oh, God.
Which I think, you know, has increased its playability almost.
This is quite a good season for adding songs to that jukebox, isn't it?
Definitely. Well, I've got some bits that I just want to put hats off to as well. That I do. First of all, the first thing I do in the morning is not say Dot and Bubble. The first thing I do in the morning is Snot and Dribble. The rest of my day, coffee. 2 hours work as per episode, internet, tea, gin, bed. So that's how my life compares to an episode of Doctor Who. I think we've got to mention the monsters.
Yes.
Because one of the phrases, because this is my little bit about my usual little section about the design bit, because I love the design and I love design generally. So in Unleashed, they did mention that Doctor Who had a past with big insects, so it had a language. And I like that they'd actually gone to the vaults and you've got sort of a bit of tractators and mirror in there. We've got sort of used to human height insectoid aliens. So I did like there was that sort of language between them, that you could see that they were of the same sort of universe.
Mm.
I also liked, we've talked about Boomtown already, which was the Slitheen, was it the Return of the Slitheen? Now, when the Slitheen first appeared, there was an awful shot where you had an amazing, sinuous, muscular CG Slitheen running down a room.
Oh,
and
yes.
And then cut to a close-up of the puppet version, bimbling along like Kermit without a hand in his head. I think that the mashup between... Well, Bashup, actually, I've called it, because that's what it's known as, where you're getting different elements and putting them together like a collage. So you've got, like, physical models with bits of CG on them and stuff. It's a Bashup, and I think it works much better now. They've certainly pushed that, I think. The colour scheme of it, well, Barbie, Sims, Animal Crossing I've got there, they're all quite attractive things to certain viewers again. So it's this thing about appealing to other people. I've also mentioned that I put down Wes Anderson as well, because I love Wes Anderson stuff, but it's almost like one of his little worlds that he's created. And I think we might have mentioned this on another episode, but the series it reminded me of, Paradise Towers.
All right.
There's a similarity between the exterior of Paradise Towers, which again, I think was a normal, everyday building with bits added to make it look futuristic. This is what they've done with a street, because this episode was featured quite a lot on location thread on Gallifrey Base. because I was thinking it looks very obviously just a really street, quite dull and dark, yeah, with this big plastic fiberglass monster on it. So it was hard to see where the Disney money was at that point, but they've added all these extra little bits in the background, different layers and levels and textures, which I think is really good. So I think the design of the whole thing was very good. I'm going to mention, you mentioned Black Mirror and Black Mirror clones and things. Now, this is interesting because I'm a big fan of things like Inside Number 9 and Going Back, Tales of the Unexpected. These things with twists on them, which Black Mirror is just another volume, basically. This episode, though, was promoted quite a lot, even by Russell T. Davis, I think, as being sort of... and I'm pretty sure that Millie mentions it as well. They actually mention Black Mirror as... that's what this episode is. The next episode, they mention it's Bridgerton. It's almost like they're trying to charm viewers from other shows to them.
I don't know. Possibly, yeah.
Maybe that's another way of trying to get people in.
Yeah. Can I just say on that... that's a very Hinchcliffe thing to do, actually, I think. If you think back to the Hinchcliffe era.
Yes, Hammer Horror.
And all the stuff that he did then. He was trying to... Because I know Russell said in an interview that he's basically... Disney said they wanted him to attract an audience of the under 30s, which is, you know, which is exactly what Philip Hinchcliffe was trying to raise viewership to the under 30s, wasn't he, back then? But a lot of those things are written because, oh, that film's just been on telly, or they've had an adaptation of it on the BBC. Yeah. So people have just watched it, and that's why it makes it onto the screen. And there's a lot of that in that era. So in a way, he's just channeling that same sort of vibe, but just in a very modern way.
But that when Sarah turns up in Solon's castle in Brady Bourbon, she doesn't go, oh, it's so Hammer Horror, does she?
No. It's just occurred to me what I was just saying as well. The bit where Lindy Pepperbean dodges the dot and turns it onto the singer. At that particular point, before we found out she's a horrible racist, at that point, do we even hate her for doing that? Because in many a superhero film, your lead hero may think, well, is sacrificing a whimsical YouTube singer bad when I could save more people and be better for the world? At that point, we could have thought she might have been a hero and that she was letting him be a hero by dying and she was going to go on and save more. But then it turned. I mean, I didn't think that, but I could have. Or did I? You know, I was thinking, God, she's quite cool at that point before she turned out to be awful. Anyway, I enjoyed the episode. I've got to say, yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, the other thing is that if you think about Genesis of the Daleks, where the Doctor doesn't destroy the Daleks and he says, well, many things could be better with the Daleks, you know, many more people become allies, etc., etc. It could almost think the same with this. They're going out now, out of their bubble into the world, and they're going to develop and they are going to evolve and mature and learn and, you know, they'll become accepting. They'll change people because they're going to learn more and be exposed to more. So perhaps they are going to become better people because of this.
I think the story makes it clear in the narrative, doesn't it, that they're all going to die.
Fair enough. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm defending any of these people.
No, God, no. I was quite excited to see that this episode was directed by Dylan Holmes-Williams, and I thought it was another great piece of direction on this story. He's really good, so I hope we get to see more of him. I thought the whole thing looked good as a Barbie pastiche, sort of. I do find those colours terribly annoying.
Yes, yeah.
There seems to be quite a lot of them in television, and a lot of things seem, I think we have alluded to that as well, and those filters, isn't there? It's like those pastely filters and that.
Yeah,
and that.
It's an on-trend palette.
Yeah, that tone of cyan, I think it is. I'm thinking back to my old Spectrum 48K keyboard and its dead flesh keys.
Do you know, as soon as you said cyan, I thought, oh, that's what I used to wonder about the five colours they had on Spectrum with computers, isn't it?
Yeah, cyan, the magenta. Yeah. Oh, wonderful days. So I've gone into a reverie now. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It's funny. It felt like another fairly skinny episode. It felt like there was three skinny episodes in a row, really.
Possibly, yeah.
Which was odd. They felt kind of whittled down to Well, obviously, two of the episodes are fairly Doctor light, really.
Mm.
And the other episode does have the Doctor in. It's all set in one location. So it's funny doing all those three in a row. I think I'm going to talk more about my general vibe about the series, actually when we get on to the next review. Yeah. But I did notice that it sounded like a little bit of James Bond music towards the end as Chuty turned round and went into the TARDIS. It sounded a bit... Oh, I need Hayden. Is it John Barry?
John Barry's your Bond guy, yeah.
Yes, I thought it was a bit of John Barry in that music towards the end.
You mention that this is something that we haven't mentioned really, and it always used to be something that got mentioned, didn't it? That Murray Gould's music,
yes,
takes over. I'm not really noticing it in this series either. It's more subtle, or I've got used to the way music works on modern TV, but I'm not noticing his music as much.
Well, it says a lot about you as to what point you notice in the episode that it's Murray Gould. I thought the acting at the end from Chuty and Millie was absolutely brilliant. I mentioned earlier watching that thing on Unleashed where they show you like a behind the scenes of them filming that scene alongside the scene that we saw on telly. So you actually get to see it kind of stripped of some of its filters. And even on that, the performance, sometimes when they do that, the performances can look a little bit odd or, lacking in something, but they didn't at all. It was just so good. And some of those shots on Chuty's face as he's talking to him as well, saying, I will do anything to save you.
Yeah.
And it's just tearing at him. And that moment of realisation when they realise what's going on and the way that Millie turns to him and just puts a hand on his arm, and it's just... Oh, it's heartbreaking. We haven't had enough moments like that between those two. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I think we don't see enough of them interacting with each other in this series up until then, and it feels to me, and that was just lovely.
Is that where he sort of screams at the end and she puts her hand on his arm?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I watched Unleashed before I rewatched it. I'd not really been concentrating, and I saw that scene. Obviously, they were saying, this is Chuty's first scene. And, he does that thing, he sort of straightens up and he laughs.
Yeah.
And then she puts out her arm to comfort him. I thought they'd said, right, cut. Then he'd laugh, just, getting rid of all of his emotion of having filmed that. And that was not Ruby comforting the Doctor. That was Millie putting out a hand to comfort Chuty after he'd just done that really emotional bit. I thought, oh, that goes really well. And I hadn't realised it's actually, once I rewatched it, that's actually part of the... So that went well. So, and yes, it is. I just re-listened to that, Mark. It is. It's very much... I'm going to have to send that to Hayden, asking to remind me which Doctor Who music it reminds us of.
No, it's James Bond.
Sorry, which James Bond music it reminds us of?
Is it a bit like on Her Majesty's Secret Service?
It's either that or it's the one in the volcano.
Oh, yeah, that is, isn't it? God, I love that theme tune.
No, I'm talking to you, it's Diamonds Are Forever, where the, the spaceship opens up and swallows the, No, that is, you're right, You Only Live Twice. Marks out of 10.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I would give the last 2 minutes 9 out of 10.
A triumph!
But I would give the whole story a 5.
The sky's falling in.
Rev?
8.
Really? Well done.
Yeah.
Marco?
I would give it a 7.
Right, okay. So we next had a tour de force from the BBC's makeup department. It was Rouge.
I keep seeing people calling it Rouge on Twitter.
Next we had Rogue, written by Kate Herron and Bryony Redman, directed by Ben Chessel, who I must admit I haven't come across before. Anyone want to take a plunge?
I haven't got much to say about this one, really.
No, nor have I.
I'm probably going to dive into what other people say if it puts things in my head, but basically I've not written much down.
I've written nothing down.
Well, we'll have to riff off Doc. I've written that it's like the Prince Charming video with Adam and the Ant is my reference point. I like the bit where he sang the Willy Wonka song.
Oh.
This one reminded me a lot of the 2005-2006 episodes. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't know, but it was very family of blood. We had a very Captain Jack kind of guy. We had animal heads, which is very RTD. And that's all I've said about it. And when I've mentioned this one to Doctor Who watching students at work, they like this one because it has that 2005-2006 vintage Doctor Who vibe. Because my students weren't born till 2007, so for them, this is the good old days, really old days. So I thought that was interesting, but that's really all I've written, so probably...
Do you want me to go on and you can just riff off me?
Yeah, I reckon, yeah, because that's me done.
Yeah.
Didn't even like the design.
My way of doing things seems to be to loathe something on first viewing, and then, actually I quite like it on repeat viewing. The other way around, I quite enjoyed it on first viewing, but on second viewing, I found it quite Emperor's New Clothes. I mean, I must say that no amount of RTD for the achievement of casting someone who's been in something, or getting a director of something famous in to be the writer, will con me into thinking something's great when it's not. I do think this writing partnership of Kate Herron and Bryony Redman promises to be more Pip and Jane Baker than Bob Baker and Dave Martin. Kate directed and executive produced the first season of Loki.
That was very good.
She directed 4 episodes of Sex Education, which I think is interesting. And they're not really written that much that I can see. Russell says, the end result is gorgeous and thrilling and scary, and not like any other episode of Doctor Who.
He's such a liar, isn't he?
In fact, the story itself is pretty much a rip-off of Empty Child Doctor Dances and Human Nature Family of Blood for me.
And Girl in the Fireplace.
Who did you lose? Do you remember when the Eccleston Doctor says to Nancy on the steps of the bridge, who did you lose? Why do you feel you've got to help all these little children? And he says to, Shooty's Doctor says to Rogue, doesn't he, who did you lose? You've also got a family of aliens who'll steal the bodies of others. That's effectively Human Nature Family Blood, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Rogue is far too much an attempt to revive Captain Jack. I saw someone on Gallifrey Base saying that, Rogue is nothing like Captain Jack at all. End of. I thought, oh no, they've said end of. I've got to shut up now.
Well, you know how to say anything else, damn then. Well, he's not as annoying as Captain Jack, I'll give you that. I think he's more of a believable person, character.
Do you think he is or isn't Captain Jack, Ish? I mean, I don't mean actually him.
I don't think he is Captain. Do I think he's Captain Jack-ish?
Yeah.
No, I think he's Captain Jack-ish, yeah.
I think it's a way of... They're trying to revive Captain Jack, a way of getting around the John Perriman issue, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. But I do think this guy's a better actor. I do think he comes across as a better character. I think John Barrowman comes across as John Barrowman too much. He melts into himself.
A gay American bounty hunter with an invisible spaceship.
Yeah, yeah.
Who surprises people at a dance by dancing with another man.
Yeah.
It's just possibly that there's similarities here. I mean, it was only the fact that he didn't have his hanging out that convinced me it was 2 different characters. I thought he was a much better actor and put on a better performance, but I didn't find much chemistry between the two of them, really. Maybe looking back to Empty Child Doctor Dances, if it had been a 2-part story, this budding relationship between the two of them might have had more room to breathe, and it could have been brought to the point where I believed it. But as much as at the end where they're trying to shock everyone by dancing together, as much as Rogue going down on one knee to propose, in inverted commas, can be sold as, oh, that's just part of their performance to shock people, I think you also need to believe on a certain level that it could possibly be genuine. And the Doctor's reaction to it shows that he's emotionally affected by it. But then he sacrifices himself, says, find me. And we end with the Doctor grinning about it. Oh, well, hard luck.
I got this tasty ring out of it. Sucker. That's what he's thinking.
That's just put my thingy pepper bean theory even more in. I don't know, you should sacrifice yourself, shouldn't you? Damn it. I mean, I've got to admit, I only watched this episode once. This is the only one of the series I've watched once. I had to watch Space Babies more than once to make sure it was what I thought it was. And it was. It was definitely there. Whereas this, I will watch it again when I watch them all back and probably enjoy it more with a bit of a nostalgic thing. Mm. But to me, it just didn't warrant watching again. It just wasn't, I don't know, it didn't seem fresh or to bring anything new to the story.
I have to say, out of all the stories that I've watched, this is one of the ones where I didn't watch it on broadcast at the midnight drop, and I didn't watch it in its broadcast slot the next day at tea time sort of thing.
No, neither did I.
No, me neither. I'd watched it on late on Saturday.
And I went online and was just scrolling through Twitter. I've muted Doctor Who and hashtag Doctor Who, hashtag spoilers and stuff. But still loads of stuff kept popping up about it in my feed. And it was just people going, oh, this is incredible. This is what Doctor Who is all about. This is just amazing. This is one of the best series ever. This episode is just fantastic. And so I was thinking, wow, that sounds way more exciting than I thought it looked myself. And I thought, well, I'm in for a real treat. And then I sat down to watch it, and yeah, it was okay. But as you say, there's nothing in this that is unprecedented. There's nothing in this we haven't seen before. And as Doc rightly pointed out, and you, Rev, as well, that, you know, Family of Blood, etc. It's all so familiar.
Those killings by the family in Family of Blood are horrific, aren't they?
Yes.
Here, they're played for broad laughs, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The cosplay reference did make me giggle, obviously, with my connection to Comic-Cons. And cosplayers will love that little reference, getting a shout-out, which is good. I'll tell you when I had a quiver of excitement.
Oh,
It turned out to be wrong. I had a quiver of excitement. When he went down on one knee with the ring and gave the Doctor the ring and the Doctor looked at it, I thought the Doctor, when he took in an intake of breath, I thought it's because he recognised a symbol on the ring or...
Oh.
He worked out who this chap was, but then it turned out not to be.
Oh.
Not the Corsair, is it, or something?
Yeah, I was trying to say that.
It could have been a Knight of Oberon.
Because it had like a little scorpion on, didn't it?
Yeah, I couldn't quite make it out.
Spectre. Oh, that's an octopus.
Well, no, but I thought that Corsair thing. Has anyone thought up any more names for Time Lords?
No.
That's...
No.
The Jolly Green Giant.
The Honey Monster.
I'm not, this doesn't sound too objectifying, but so far, The Devil's Chord, one of the Beatles one, is still the only episode since she joined that they've managed to put Millie in something that's flattering, clothes-wise. Half the time she's in this sort of tartan miniskirt.
Gave her that Leela quality.
A tartan miniskirt and black leggings. Here she's in a sort of dowdy yellow. Why yellow? I guess because she's got blondish hair, isn't she?
It reminded me a bit of Tegan in Enlightenment.
The yellow is a design reference that was in Doctor Who Unleashed.
Oh,
yellow suits blonde people.
Oh, right. And dear, oh dear. Here they're writing Ruby as thick and common. Not just the fact that her frame of reference for this place is Bridgerton, rather than, oh, Jane Austen. I don't think you'd believe for a second that she's read Jane Austen, would you, Ruby?
Well, I'll tell you what it reminded me of, again, as an echo back to the earlier series that we're talking about, the Matt Gaetis episode, the zombie one, Unquiet Dead, where Rose is talking to the maid.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
and in her modern language, and oh, you say the most frightful things. The things have come out of your mouth.
God, yeah, it's just an
apologies for the accent.
Perhaps this is what the toy maker meant when he said to the Doctor, "I have made a jigsaw of your life."
Yeah, it's what The Force Awakens was to the original Star Wars trilogy.
The Cad, the Bounder, approaches Ruby on the dance floor, says to the Duchess, "Oh, where have you been hiding this absolute delight with hair like golden strands spun in the rays of the evening sun?" He said from memory. And obviously that's a perfectly reasonable, what maybe some Regency book might say to flatter a woman, isn't it? And she says, "Oh, you're not at all glass at all. You have a pint of shandy." Then he admittedly says something stupid like, "My dear, you should learn to be admired in silence." That should be a great cue for Ruby to do some form of clever Regency put-down.
"You are!"
Where she says, "If you spoke to me and the girls like that on a Friday night down at Spinning Wheel, we'd rip you a new one, mate." And you go, "Oh, bloody." That's what I mean, thick and common. What's the other one? "Oh, we mate Bex. She tied to a lamppost in his pants." All presumably intended to show her as sassy and feisty. Instead, she just comes across as a sort of Sharon in a club who can't hold her drink. Rose, God, nearly 20 years ago, Rose came across as someone who could always have been so much more than a shop girl. In this, Ruby comes across as someone who'd be lucky to be even that. But, there we are.
Can I just say something else? This is amazing. You've just done this, Doc. Not the episode. That where she said, if you said that to me, the girls down, the spinning wheel. 2007, Jackie Tyler agreed to meet a friend at the spinning wheel for a pub quiz in Love and Monsters.
Oh.
8 o'clock, spinning wheel, pub quiz, get him in. Something like that.
I mean, I was thinking that, I don't think of the Twisted Wheel, which was a nightclub in Manchester, and I was thinking, that closed in the 70s.
Northern Soul?
Yes. Oh, I see what you mean. Hmm, yes.
Can I say something about this?
No. No, you can't. Who do you think you are? Who do you think you are?
No. Okay. Sorry, I'll get back in my cabinet.
Fire on, man.
Creep and nail it shut. There's the bit where, going back to like the immediacy of this season that I think I commented on in Space Babies, the fact that it felt like we'd hit the ground halfway through a season almost, like as if the relationship between the characters had been developed off screen without us ever seeing it. And it's the same here again, because the Doctor does what Tom's Doctor used to do with Sarah Jane, say, "This is my best friend." And when it was Tom and Sarah Jane, you really felt he meant that because of their relationship that we saw, the time they stayed together and everything they've been through, and the amount of time. We just spent time with them talking to each other, chatting. You'd have pictures of them just walking through fields, chatting away to each other and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. That's huge love of mine in those days.
And just the type of companion and the Doctor just chatting away and having mundane chatter and pointing at cows and things like that or whatever, you know. We just get none of that. And so when he says, "This is my best friend," it's just, it doesn't, I don't know, I don't mean to be a gatekeeper, but it doesn't feel earned.
I wonder if the problem is that nowadays, which didn't happen in the Sarah Jane Tom day, Fourth Doctor days, so often, part of the reason why he's dragging his female companion along with him is because she's something special, isn't she? Oh, she's...
Yeah.
Is she dragging along because she's a friend, or because he's he wants to find out what the whole... Who was left at the church on Christmas Eve?
Yes. It's very Amy's Crack and The Impossible Girl and stuff, isn't it?
You know, where he scanned her in the TARDIS.
Yeah, we still don't know.
But then, like I was saying last time about how, in order to make the Lord of the Rings trilogy of films fit into a theatrical production length, they cut out all the non-plot scenes. So there's no time for them just to gossip to each other. It has to be, you know, at the end when they're sitting on the steps in the garden, is about to go away, and he says, oh, there's far too many dimensions. As many dimensions as there are atoms in the universe. That has to be. We've got to use that 2 minutes to deliver plot points and plot lines. We can't just have them saying, how did you like the dance?
Did anyone have any particular feelings regarding the kiss? Which I think some people have tried to make out it's controversial. I mean, to me, the only problem I have with it is I don't particularly like the Doctor being...
romantically involved.
Necessarily sexually interested in people. Romantically involved. It's not something... I don't know.
Yeah.
The river thing I kind of got because that kept reoccurring and it was threaded through and it had that nice poetic thing of... I enjoyed it because it was her going one direction down the timeline, him going the other, and I found that really interesting.
I think for me it's part of being it's the joy of it being part of a series that is 60 years old that appeals to different generations after different generations yet keeps the previous generations.
Exactly, yeah.
TV is a different beast these days and it is an evolving thing. Yet when I was the target audience, I liked that the Doctor was just this eccentric chap who came to a place, fought some monsters, and then left. I was happy with that, but people crave more now. They crave soap opera elements to it, plot lines. Everyone, well, not everyone. I mean, there's certain generations who like Love Island and things like that. So Russell T. Davies brings those elements into it, where there is romance and will they, won't they's. Different people crave different things, and I think that's the joy of the Doctor. He's a multifaceted character, and everybody gets what they want from an episode, hopefully.
I mean, it didn't bother me. I'm just being an old cynic, and sometimes I find some of the love stuff cringy.
It's not new, though, is it?
I didn't like it with Rose, because she seemed far too to be like a teen for the... Somebody who's hundreds of years old to fall in love with a teenager always felt a bit weird.
Yeah, it's what they were building towards with Jodie Whittaker as well, wasn't it?
Well, no, I don't think they decided on that until the end, did they? I think Chibnall himself said...
Well, I think they probably let fandom lead that one, didn't they? The forums.
Giving people what they want. Except Chibnall sort of didn't give them what they wanted either, did he? I don't think he pleased anyone with that. But again, I suppose the fact that it's interracial is something, but that to me doesn't seem like a big deal. But perhaps it does to other people, I don't know. Perhaps I'm looking at it from a position of privilege, but I don't find it shocking to see or anything. I did like the bit where he sung the song from Willy Wonka.
Pure imagination. I loved that bit.
That was a really nice few seconds of a real showpiece for Shooty, I thought, because he is terribly charismatic, and we don't always see it in every performance of his in this series, but that was just that little section there where he stood at the door, you know, ushering someone in and singing that. And I thought it was excellent stuff.
What did we think of the holographic circle of doctors going around the Doctor's head?
Oh, yeah, because this has been talked about a lot, hasn't it? Because we've got the Scream of the Shalka Doctor in it, Richard E. Grant's in it. He's also the Great Intelligence, isn't he?
Yes.
So this was scanning his DNA, wasn't it?
I think at this point it's just a bit of fun same way as other things have in the past, but somebody will probably riff on it in the future, a future showrunner or at Russell T. Davies himself.
I saw Richard E. Grant's response online. He did a little video of himself after he'd just watched it, and he was so excited. I was punching the air. I was cheering. Wonderful, wonderful. And, yeah, he was really chuffed to be featured, which is funny after Russell T. Davies slagged him off.
Yeah, he was in the Loki TV series as well, wasn't he? He was not
he was.
Loki. So
yes.
That's another nice little link. Everything's connected.
When did RTD slag him off?
He didn't like his performance in Scream of the Shalka.
Oh, right.
Yes. He said it was a lazy performance. He just took the money and ran.
That can't be true, surely. Computer, could you find Russell T. Davies' comment about Richard E. Grant, please? Dr. Doctor Who magazine number 360. Paul Cornell put so much life and work into the Scream of the Shalka project, says Russell, and the TV series crushed it, and I thought that was a shame. I wasn't a fan of Richard E. Grant in it, I have to say. And yes, you can print that. I thought he was terrible. I thought he took the money and ran, to be honest. It was a lazy performance. He was never on our list to play the Doctor.
It was a flash animation, you know.
I do like how RTD is always completely honest about things like this. Oh, what's this? Chris Chibnall, he's my hero. Oh, well.
Oh.
Do you get the impression we've even started to see where all the Disney money is going yet?
Yeah, no, I think we do.
I think the TARDIS set was a lot of it.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
I think the outside of Captain Rogue's spaceship...
Captain Rogue!
Yeah, Captain Rogue's spaceship was pretty impressive.
They're building a lot of physical sets.
Yeah. Mm. This is the other thing as well. A lot of stuff that I think would be CGI before, they're actually building and you're getting these proper sets. Like the slugs in the last thing, like watching the design of them. Oh, that's one thing I want to say about that on Bubble thing was I was really impressed watching The Unleashed, how much Russell T. Davies' designs for them.
Oh, his little cartoons, they're great.
Which are brilliant. And the designs for the bubble. And those all got made, and it's I love that he's got such a hands-on thing that he does these little sketches, these little cartoons.
Oh, he's very good at that, isn't he? Yeah.
I love that that he's got that kind of handle on the show. But a lot of the things are physical these days, whereas before they'd be purely CGI. And the CGI is so much better than it used to be. I haven't seen The Unleashed for Rogue, so I don't know how much work went into the bird costumes.
One of the things they talk about a lot on that special effects-wise is also the emaciated bodies that the aliens steal.
Yes.
So they're mentioned quite a lot. The bear makeup is mentioned as well, but a lot of this one has gone on costume, very definitely.
Oh, really?
Especially the background artists. Yeah, they've set up several different looks for each background artist and put a lot of time and attention into that.
I thought they'd just hire those, wouldn't they?
No, because you'd have an overall colour palette for the episode and placings of certain colours in certain scenes. You'll often see that certain clothing matches maybe an ornament or a book or a vase or a vehicle in a scene, so it's to help take your eye and creates almost like a painting.
There's one aspect of this that really irritated me on viewing, and I've managed to retcon it in my head, so it's not so annoying. Mm. But I did not like the way that Ruby got out of being killed by pushing aside her face and going battle mode.
That was quite obvious, wasn't it, when you right at the start when he said, oh, never use battle mode. You thought, oh, well, that's what's coming up, is it?
Yes.
That was very Chekhov's gun, wasn't it? Chekhov's earrings.
Now, I think he said that as a joke. But I think, like a lot of things seem to be being said in this series, and then they become real. Mm. And this is this whole thing about myths becoming real, isn't it? And every time Ruby starts saying stuff like, talking about things like Bridgerton, and then they end up in these scenarios, which are them, and it's like the stuff the cast are saying is coming true. And so that's what I think the battle mode thing is. I don't think it has existed before, and I think it's something to do with this, with whatever the One Who Waits is and what the toy maker's done.
I hope it isn't. They reference more of this and Susan Twist. I hope a lot of these things come together because Russell T. Davies said in this series they were going to release this plethora of godlike characters. Well, we had the toy maker and now Maestro, but that's it. So, it's you know, it hasn't been a plethora through the series, so it's got to come in the next two episodes, hasn't it?
Yes. So, I'm wondering, because I don't watch any of the Next Time trailers. And I've muted Doctor Who pretty much out on my Twitter timeline, but it still crops up. I keep seeing pictures of people going, oh, look, it's And there's the thing of S Triad. What's the company called?
S Triad.
And so this is what I'm... Is Susan Twist, is she... Because she, in The Giggle, the Doctor makes another TARDIS, doesn't he? In fact, the Doctor splits the TARDIS into two,
yeah.
Essentially, doesn't he? He does the bi-regeneration trick with the TARDIS. And his TARDIS keeps making funny noises. You notice that Shooty keeps getting scared and Chief Doctor keeps crying, like he's kind of missing a bit of his self. And he said as much, hasn't he? He said he's had his soul ripped apart or whatever. I'm thinking he's done the same to the TARDIS and that Susan Twist is the other TARDIS.
Yeah. Well, there's this that came out this week as well, isn't it? Isn't there's going to be an episode of... Is it Tales from the TARDIS, the thing where the book ended the classic episodes in this memory TARDIS?
Yeah. Yeah.
They've announced a new episode of that with the current TARDIS team, but set in the memory TARDIS. And I've not gone through it again, but some people have said that the memory TARDIS is in the series trailer.
Oh.
So this comes out, the Tales from the TARDIS comes out on... Friday, if I'm thinking correctly.
Oh, is it?
It's like a prelude.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was June the 20th, which I think is a Thursday.
All right, so it's not. I thought it was the 14th, so it's the day before the final episode.
Oh, right. I wonder if Susan will be in that, if Carol Ann will be in that.
Well, who knows? Also, I'm wondering if S Triad...
Hang on, what is this S Triad thing, sir?
S Triad, there's a picture of Susan Twist standing in front of a big thing that's like a corporate logo that says S Triad.
It's Susan Twist's character, is it? S Triad Technology.
So, yeah, S Triad
Technology. So she's called S Triad.
And also, her name is Susan, and it's Susan Triad Technology, Sue Tech.
Oh, doesn't he say?
That's clever, isn't it? I bet loads of people have noticed that. It's been all over the internet, and this is like the first time I've heard it. Oh, my God, that's clever, isn't it? Oh, wow.
So I wonder if the other TARDIS has joined forces with C-Tech.
Well, do you remember, you know when he's Rogue is walking the Doctor through the garden to his spaceship, and he says, oh, what's that shed? I said, it's my TARDIS.
Mm.
And he says, yeah. He doesn't just say, does he? It's bigger on the inside. Doesn't he say it harnesses technology which enables it to be able to be bigger on the inside?
Yeah.
But that seemed to be, I thought that seemed to be a bizarre way of putting it. Did they, or were they trying to get that word technology into the...
It does feel like there's a lot of things, there's a lot of seeds and things being planted across these stories. I saw somebody else point out that the Doctor stepping on things was like, which is very true, because he... I think every episode, well, although I can't think of anything in Dot and Bubble, but I mean, there's...
He steps on the fairy ring, doesn't he?
There's the stepping on the butterfly.
Yeah. But that was her, wasn't it?
Mm.
Basically, yes, but okay, so it's not just always the Doctor, but... So there was stepping on the butterfly, and then there was stepping on the landmine.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Mm.
The old cosplay. And yeah, the fairy ring. Every episode, there's been... Yeah, bits where he's where wow. Him or something. So
this is nuts.
It's just odd that these
Mark,
themes.
You're twisting my melon, man.
Am I talking so hip? See, I've been hearing about Sutech for ages. It was only when I saw, and I thought, no, that's probably bollocks. But then I saw S Triad Technology, and that's what made me think. Hold on, so that's Susan and that's what made me think. Susan Tech.
Right. So you know the other thing, don't you? We've mentioned this already, haven't we? Where in Boom they go and look at the future world, the future Earth, as they did in Pyramids of Mars.
Yes,
yeah, that was.
Don't show what could happen.
That was Devil's Court.
Writes itself, doesn't it?
So there's lots of stuff threaded through this series. It's going to be very interesting to look back on. Overall, I think that the series has been better than... It's gotten above my expectations, generally. And I've been quite happy with it. So there. And I wonder if all this self-referencing stuff, the fact that, like I say, nothing in this entire series really has been unprecedented, has it? Despite the fact that Then you always get the clips of Russell going, oh, this has never been done before. And it's like, hey, you've done it like five times before. Come on. It's interesting. I hope this all wraps up nicely. I hope it doesn't end up being a bit of a kind of Stephen Moffat series six kind of thing where you're left going, ah.
I must say that, just going back a bit, as three men in our 50s, the listeners as one gasp, what? Never! It can't be true! As three men in our 50s, we felt very jealous of Lindy Pepperbean being able to wake up, get straight out of bed and be told her bladder's empty.
Well, exactly what I meant. Yes, not on dribble. We, coffee, we.
Well, you're up three times in the night. Marks out of 10?
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
Marco.
I will give this another 7, I think.
Revered 1?
Yeah, I think it's a 5 from me.
A 6 from me, because I liked it much more the first time around. It's a pretty insane. When you've only got an 8-episode series, and you've got stuff like Space Babies, that I gave a 0 to, Dot and Bubble, which is only really interesting for the last 2 minutes. You really need a much longer series to be able to cope with that sort of thing. You know, that many duff episodes, I think. Now, we have a letter from friend of the show, Dominic Smith. Dot Bubble. This series started weekly, got better, got a bit strange, and then came here and blew all the others out of the water. The 13th Doctor's era was all good ideas, no idea how to end the story. Chibnall can't write a third act. This is a good idea, with some nice touches and excellent set pieces, and an ending that makes you go back and re-watch it in a totally different way. Wow. The performances of all the characters were top rate. Callie Cook, as Lindy, really blows you away on a second watch. The Doctor's amazing, and Ruby, you have to love her. Who is Susan Twist? And it's great to see they recognise her now as well. I bet there are people who hate it, but 8.5 for me. I would give it more, but I think there might need to be places to move to. More Time Lords hidden on TV? The Man in a Suitcase? The Hooded Claw? Penelope Pitstop? The Tourist? The Apprentice? The Bachelor? The Traitors? The Bear and the Flash? As always, what a show. The three-header works so well with the Rev. Oh, he means us.
Wow.
As always, what a show.
Hooray!
The three-header works so well with the Rev, who I'm just discovering. Hayden must be my twin, as we are close on scoring. Oh. I have to say I'm very disappointed about the plans for the 200th podcast. This is a step down from the planned flypast, the parade of Zabi over Westminster Bridge, and seaweed monsters outside St. Paul's you did for the 100th. No beacons being lit across the globe? No drone display over the Hooseum? Not even a cosplay competition? I'd planned to attend dressed as Clive from Rose. I watched Rogue a bit later this week. I was helping at Big Finish Day all day, and I've spent the last couple of days thinking about it. Firstly, I don't watch Bridgerton, and I don't really need to be told repeatedly that this is just like one programme. You could have said it's like Pride and Prejudice and achieved the same thing. Positives to start with, it looked good. The direction was solid, and the makeup on the aliens was imaginative. Nice to see they all look different, and they seem to have a personality. But why is Russell obsessed with aliens looking like animals? Once or twice it was clever, I now find it boring. Rogue was Captain Jack, without the questionable and alleged backstage behaviour. He was also without some of the charm and wit. It's like if you ordered John Barrowman on Wish. I've never liked the Doctor being romantically linked, and this was a bit over the top and distracting for me. But it was believable. Both actors were giving great performances. This was the best and most we had seen Shooty for weeks, and it was good to have him back. It showed what a Doctor-shaped hole there has been in some episodes this year. Millie also looked like she was having fun and had a great side story. But keeping them apart means the chemistry again doesn't have time to develop. Overall, it was a stylish swish, enjoyable romp, with a love story that was a bit too far forward and not engaging enough. In fact, it was distracting. That brings it down one mark to 7 out of 10. I bet Doc hates those. If he gives it 5, I'll be amazed. Mark will be kinder with 6. So how many answers will we get next week? Right, well, listeners, we shall be back in a week or so with our review of the 2-part finale of this series, which will be our 200th podcast. Which, as I said, we may decide to play it too cool for school and just not make anything of it. So we'll see.
I'd just like to... friend of mine and Doc's, who we know from the capital, Andrea, at TARDIS Parrot, and I know she's having a very...
Oh, of course, yes.
Very difficult time at the moment, and she's just... she's had a much worse time in hospital recently, certainly than I have, and I'm sure we'd all like to wish her a speedy recovery and all the best.
Mm.
Andrea, if you need it, once we've kicked Mark out of it, the Zero Room cabinet is here for you to use any time you like, love. And so, in that case, until next time, goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye, all.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to the Diddly Dum podcast. Find us on Twitter at @diddly_dum or on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can find links to us on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, Facebook, Instagram, and Mastodon. Or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.